We just had another warmest year on record in 2016. That's 3 years in a row with the warmest surface temperatures on the planet. The information comes from reliable scientific sources, NASA and NOAA, which runs the National Weather Service. The question for most of the world has been the same for years. What do we do with the information? When an issue affects the whole world, it can be hard to get a perspective on how to address it as an individual or community. There are 7 billion plus people on the Earth. But groups committed to affecting climate change on a local level abound, and we'll spend this hour visiting with several, including Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, where Alan Journay is the co-facilitator. And across the table from here in the studio, Alan, good to see you.
Thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Hannah Soule is here as well, just arrived in the room. She is with Rogue Climate. And what is your position at Rogue Climate, Hannah?
I'm the director.
You're the director of Rogue Climate. Okay, I want to make sure we're clear on that one. Tanya Graham is with us as well. She is the executive director of the Geos Institute based in Ashland. Good to see you, Tanya.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
And we have with us from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, of all places, Allison Carey, who is the director of the American Revolution's United States History Project. Allison, good to have you on the phone.
Very nice to be here. Thank you.
All right, take care. Alan, talk about how SOCAN got started and what the goals of your group are.
Okay, we were initiated in 2012 when my wife and I moved to the area. In 2010, we were surprised to find there was not in the area at that point a grassroots group that was devoted to action on climate change. And so with a number of folks in the area, we started Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. We're now an organization of over 1,000. And our focus is on two things. One, education. We figure the first thing that people need to do is understand the science of global warming and climate change, and we are using that education as a way of stimulating people to take personal and collective action to address the problem. So two-point focus, education and motivating action at the individual and collective level.
Education and action, which sounds similar to the goals at Rogue Climate. What is the difference between the two organizations, Hannah Soule?
So I think you've asked me this before even. But so Rogue Climate, we're really focused on grassroots organizing and providing a space for young people and people who haven't traditionally been active in clean energy and climate action to get active. We work on three primary campaigns. So one is to stop steps that take us backwards, like the Pacific Connector Pipeline, and then also to move forward local practical solutions to climate change, like local clean energy action plans and policies at the state level that help our communities transition to clean energy and create jobs in our communities.
And so, Alan, to come back to you,
yes.
Are you not as active at SOCAN about things like pipelines and stuff like that?
Well, what we tend to do with the pipeline issue, for example, rather than reinventing the wheel, what we do is support Rogue Climate and the Rogue Riverkeeper in their efforts to address that issue.
So you find ways to be complementary to each other's tasks.
Yeah, and we do, I might point out, we do work a lot with Rogue Climate and the other groups in the area on the issues where we intersect, particularly legislation, which we undoubtedly will get to talking about as we go through the hour.
Undoubtedly. Tanya Graham, as the executive director of Geos Institute, which I have known by a couple of names over the years, Headwaters years ago, seemed to be at one time more broadly focused environmentally, but has your focus come a little more narrowly upon climate change as the years have gone by?
Yes. So we had what is essentially a merger in 2006, and at that point really stopped and took a look at what was the most important work that needed to be done as we looked out into the future. And clearly climate change and how it impacts natural systems was a big part of that. And so that's really where we took that turn and moved our programs specifically into climate change driven programs. So now the focus of our organization now is to help both natural and human communities remain whole in the face of changing climate conditions. And so we do that focused on public forest management, watershed management, specifically with municipal water managers, and then also with community leaders. So we bring them the best available science and help them make good climate change decisions.
All right. Easy to say that we have three environmental groups at the table, but then we get into the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and it's a somewhat different story, at least in terms of the major goals of the organization. Allison Carey, give us an idea of how the Oregon Shakespeare Festival has been and is getting involved in climate change.
Well, we have, as part of our long-term plan passed a couple of years ago, a focus on stewardship, and we really look at it sort of expansively. We also have in the organization a committee called the Green Task Force, which looks a lot at our business practices and how we can change them to be more environmentally friendly. But I also think the big question for artists all across the country and anyone working on climate change is how do we most effectively communicate what needs to be communicated to move the will of the people as far as it needs to go? And one of the challenges, of course, when we approach people sort of exclusively through the cognitive realm, sometimes the information can overwhelm people and scare people and lock them down. And so art has the possibility of bringing affect, you know, into the discussion. And hopefully that can help get people unstuck. But it also reminds you, you know, that humans create remarkable things. You know, you learn that whenever you look at a work of art, and that same instinct that can imagine and create a work of art is the same one that can imagine and create a better future. So we have to sort of get the artists in people engaged in how we look towards the improvement of our lives and the stewardship of our natural world.
So you look at your own practices first, make sure that those are in concordance with what you're thinking about the approaches to climate change. And then has there been much artwork? Has there been much on stage that has directly addressed climate change?
There's a growing number of things. And there's also ways that we're relooking, for example, this year in most of our conversations in our education department and with various audiences, we're going to take a moment to remind people that all the plays that happen on OSF stage have an environment around them, and the choices that people make in these plays actually affect the environment. There's a really good example in a play, All the Way, that we did a few years ago about LBJ's first year, where he, to get a certain senator to vote for the Civil Rights Act, he gives away some of the Colorado water rights, right? And we don't follow the train of that reality in the play, but you can, with any play, just open it up a little, and it helps us rethink the way we connect what our choices are to the choices, to how they affect the natural world.
Climate change, a global issue, and taking local action, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange. Allison Carey is with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. She is the director of the American Revolution's American History Cycle. Tanya Graham is the executive director of Geos Institute. Hannah Soles, the director of Rogue Climate. Alan Journay is the co-facilitator of Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. You can join the conversation. We want to hear news from your community. What's going on locally to affect climate change where you live? Tell us your story at 800-838-3760 over the phone, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Hannah Soule, what Allison was just saying about the people can get scared and locked down a bit by the daunting nature of what to do about climate change. I would imagine that's a fairly regular thing you find at the local level. People just don't quite know what to do. So what are some of the baby steps you walk through before they can take larger strides?
You know, I think one of the things that's really important is that to take on this overwhelming thing that's climate change is really to join with other people to take action. So what we found in our communities is that even national action sometimes feels too big to people. And so we've really tried to bring it down to the local level. So in Talent, we have a community group that's developing a clean energy action plan, and they're doing that with their neighbors, with their city council. And then in Ashland tonight, actually, we have a really important vote at the city council level. The city of Ashland, because of community pressure and community support, has developed a clean energy and climate action plan that really looks at both adaptation, so preparing for climate change, and also mitigation or reducing the impacts or reducing climate pollution. And so they're going to be voting on that tonight. And that's been a really long process where the community has been able to get involved throughout the last year. And the city has now taken a really bold approach to taking on climate change. And Tanya can talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, the city of Ashland has really shown incredible leadership around this issue. And specifically, the plan that they're looking at tonight has science-based targets. So when communities are often looking at how are they going to address climate change, the default is too often, well, what do we know how to do? What do we think we could do with a certain amount of work, as opposed to what do we have to do in order to ensure a safe climate? And the city's ad hoc group that's been working on this for the last 18 months has really dug into what are the science-based targets that our community and all communities really globally need to hit in order to ensure a safe climate for our children. And so this plan that's coming forward and the proposal for an ordinance is a really solid, honest look at what is it really going to take to do this work for our children.
And what's really cool is that a lot of youth have really been engaged in this plan. So especially for young people, when we look at climate change, it's scary. And, you know, just changing your light bulbs isn't enough. We need systemic change. We need policy change. And so a group of Ashland high schoolers over the last year has been going to city council meetings, ad hoc committee meetings, and really asking our leadership to take the leadership of the city to take real leadership. And so the youth have played an amazing role in taking action. And through this last year, we've seen them really step into amazing leadership roles by pushing for this science-based clean energy and climate action plan.
I noticed when Senator Ron Wyden was in town for a town hall meeting recently, he got a pretty good-sized earful from some young people about the LNG pipeline and his stance on that. Was that in part prompted by the folks at Rogue Climate, or was this, did this rise from within the high school first?
Yep, so there's a group at Ashland High School that Rogue Climate supports called Ashland Youth Climate Action, and those are the same youth that are pushing for a science-based ordinance at the city level and also are calling on Senator Ron Wyden to take a stand against the pipeline.
I'd like to echo that Hannah and Rogue Climate have been very effective at bringing some of the high school kids into this. The other point I wanted to make was, and there's a phrase, and I'm trying to remember the end of it, something like action is the antidote to depression or pessimism. And I think as Hannah started answering that question, I think that's exactly correct. One of the greatest antidotes, I know I certainly feel this way, to being totally depressed about the situation we're in is to do something. And if folks out there are feeling depressed and pessimistic, we encourage them to come out and join us.
Has it gotten to that point for you personally, Alan, where you just felt like, oh, my God, what are we going to do? This thing? We're just trying to run off a cliff here.
What can I say? Frequently? and I will say over the last few months, even more so.
Can't imagine why that would be.
No, I know. Right. We don't need to go there, probably.
Yeah, we don't want to get too political, but we do want to get your input on how you approach climate change in your community. And so we're entertaining folks who are involved in the process already. Alan Jornes with Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. Hannah Soule is the director of Rogue Climate. Tanya Graham is with the Geos Institute. Allison Carey is with the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Join us to talk about what's going on in your town. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Ann and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. So there's one word that the people who are advocating measures to combat global climate change are afraid to say. And this word has to do with something that causes deforestation, it causes increased urbanization, it causes increased industrialization, and that word is overpopulation. If we don't do something to stem the increase in human population on this planet, we are simply circling the drain to extinction as a species. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate that. Let's go to the Geos Institute for that one first, because you have Earth in your name. this is a big topic that has divided environmental organizations over the years. And so tell us about what the thinking is of the Geos Institute about how overpopulation dovetails in with other issues involving the environment.
Well, there's no doubt that the per capita consumption really matters. So we have two issues here. One is just the sheer number of people on the planet. But the other issue is how much does a person in, say, a Western industrialized nation use in terms of energy, and how much does a person in a developing country use? And that question has been a really difficult one for people to try to figure out for a long time. What we know, and this is really, this issue isn't something that the Geos Institute typically works on, it's more of an international issue, but what we know is that when people's lives improve and when they have better access to education, particularly girls, as their lives improve and they are able to manage the size of their families, they do. And so there's absolutely a need to help people have that control over their life. And at the same time, we have to absolutely address the consumption levels in the industrialized world. So that we simply are not going to get to a safe climate without dealing with the fact that we use an incredible amount of energy. And so both of those things are true. But what we can work on in our space is really the energy consumption, where that energy comes from, how we use it in our daily lives here in Southern Oregon and in the United States.
Is there a plank about overpopulation in the platform of either of your two groups at SOCAN or Rogue Climate? Alan Journay, you're nodding yes.
Yes, and I totally agree with Tanya's point. The issue, and we address this, we have a series of position statements, and one of them addresses population, and the position statement that we have, and I can't remember it verbatim, so I won't try and even quote it, but the basic position that we point out is population is a problem, but it's not so much the number of people, but it's what they do, exactly as Tanya said. If you look at the average Indonesian Bangladeshi, their contribution to environmental problems is about 1/60th or 1/70th of the average American Canadian. And so what we have to address is the consumption issue. And I get really nervous, and I don't know whether this is the issue that is prompting people to say that environmentalists avoid the problem. But I get very nervous because I often hear people blaming the problem on population. And my concern is if we do that, if we sit in the United States and say the problem is overpopulation, we're in danger of saying, well, it's all their fault, and failing to recognize that the United States, Canada, are the major contributors to pretty much all of the environmental problems. Let's take climate change particularly. When you look at the historical cumulative impact of us versus the average Bangladeshi or Indonesian, you can see that we're the problem, not them. But they have legitimate, again, as Tanya said, they have legitimate aspirations. And the problem that we face is if everybody on the planet used resources and produced byproducts at the rate that we do here, there's no doubt my depression would be amazingly greater than it is now. Mm-hmm. We have to address consumption. And when you look at the studies of Rogue Valley energy use and greenhouse gas emissions, what you find is it's our consumption that's on the top. I think 44% of our greenhouse gas emissions result from our consumption.
I want to ask Hannah Soule about this, though, because since you do tend to skew younger in what you're doing with Rogue Climate, if you get some real wide eyes sometimes when you explain some of the issues that we've just heard about, where our energy consumption per person is that different from what it's like in the developing world.
So I was stuck a little bit on the overpopulation question, which I think Tanya really, really captured, that, you know, if you give kids education and young women education, then it's really not a problem anymore. You know, I think that we really need to transition to clean energy. And, you know, as we look to the future, we can see that that's an option. And what's in the way is large power companies, large fossil fuel companies standing in the way of that. And so we have an opportunity right now to really change the course of climate change and to really start transitioning to clean energy, changing how we build buildings, changing how our transportation systems work. And the sooner we do that, the sooner that that we can really start taking action on climate change and ensure that our communities now and also our communities in the future really have a safe and stable climate to move forward in.
Let's take a call here. We have Pam and Dexter on the line. Pam, good to hear from you. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about climate change.
Hi. Well, I want to echo the previous caller because I definitely think we need to start talking about people having less children. Obviously, it's a twofold thing, less consumption, less human population. And personally, I wouldn't want to bring a child into the world with this uncertain future. It certainly wouldn't help, and it would make me stay up at night a lot more. The Elliott State Forest, which is up for sale, and the State Land Board is going to meet April 11th. 40,000 acres of this native old-growth forest sequesters more carbon per acre than any forest in the world. And if it gets sold, it's going to get logged. So there's a local regional action that we could take today by calling Treasurer Tobias Reed and telling him to be on the right side of history and to vote with Governor Brown on her public proposal. Carbon farming is a whole new thing. Basically, it's small local organic farming that has more no-till practices, perennial farming, because half the carbon, for instance, in the forest is stored in the soils, so whenever you disturb the soils, even with thinning, you're releasing huge amounts of carbon. And I'm reading a really excellent book right now called The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times by Michael Brownlee, and it talks about how Syria, The conflict in Syria started from years of drought, and it's most likely due to climate change. So just by buying local and supporting this, these kind of farming practices, you can do a lot. 1,500 miles is what the average product travels to get to the grocery store. And then there's energy conservation. We all talk about transitioning to renewable energy. Well, right now we can turn the lights off. We can lower the heat. We can lower our consumption immediately. It's something we can all do, and it saves you money. So I don't know why that's not number one on the list, because it's something we can all do immediately. And if we do it in mass, they won't need to be putting in the Jordan Cove pipeline and the LNG and all that.
Okay.
And I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Pam. Appreciate it. I want to turn to Tanya first, because the first thing Pam mentioned was the Elliott State Forest, and I imagine this is probably something that you've been looking at the Geos Institute, the potential transfer of land to a private entity there, 82,500 acres of Oregon State Forest.
Right. So our Forest Legacies Initiative works on that relationship between forests and carbon, and what role forests should appropriately play in dealing with climate change. And what we know is that the forests of the Pacific Northwest are champions at sequestering and storing carbon. And they have to be, the appropriate management of those forests has to be a major part of the United States efforts to address climate change. We simply cannot do this without looking at how we are managing our forests. The best way we can do that is to make sure that we are able to manage those forests. So keeping public forests public is really important in that whole space. And what we're seeing is that as finances and financial considerations and governments are under stress with those things, that they're looking to potentially sell some public lands both at the state level and then nationally. And what that's meaning is that we have that question before us as a society. Are we going to hold on to these really important landscapes, and so that we can manage them going forward?
All right. The conversation will continue about climate change. We'll come back and talk more with our guests and take more phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. It's 8:36 on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're online at jeffexchange.org. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. And, of course, you can take part in the conversation as it happens. We are taking stock of local and regional efforts to address climate change on this Hour of the Exchange. You are invited to join with details of what's going on locally to address global warming. Our guests are Alan Journay from Southern Oregon Climate Action Now. He's the co-facilitator. Hannah Soule is the Rogue Climate Director. Tanya Graham, the Executive Director at the Geos Institute. Allison Carey from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival is the director of the American Revolutions Project. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Allison Carey, I want to bring you back in because I know some of the efforts involve working with the city of Ashland at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Have you been involved with the development of the Climate and Energy Action Plan for the city?
Yeah, Claudia Alec, who is our producer of community relations, I suppose that's not her title, but she has been very active. She's been in every meeting. She was asked by the mayor to serve, and so that's been a great honor, and to be able to represent what we hope for the future of Ashland is great, because I think everybody holds many hopes in common, and there are challenges, you know, that, for example, having a tourist-based economy and lots of people driving here and lots of people flying here, it puts a different level of responsibility on us as people to be more intentional about the choices we make to help mitigate the damage that that kind of thing does. I mean, but it's also true that there was a study done, which I don't think has been published lately, that when people go to the theater, it means that they're not using energy in a lot of other ways. And so the sort of collective gathering of human beings actually tends to reduce our footprint. And so
because they're not all at home firing up their TV sets.
Exactly. And, yeah. And their phones. So it's, we have to remember that it's also what we do with our time, right? And that in terms of the inspiration that collective action can bring, or just sitting in a dark room with people and being a human being, that's a great way to spend your time. That's not that is also making the planet rest a little easier.
It was interesting to read through the strategic plan of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and see the ways in which you've turned inward first on climate change before you turned outward to look at the things you do, like you're talking about, bringing the tourists in and what that does for energy consumption, but also looking at the fact that as summers get hotter and in some cases drier in southern Oregon, you have issues with wildfires that actually have shut down productions a couple times in the last few years, haven't they?
Yeah, and it's heartbreaking to see. There's one time we had to cancel three shows in a row, and there was a little girl who was dressed up as a fairy. She was going to go see Midsummer Night's Dream, and she just had these big eyes, and we had to cancel the show because the performers, it's just too smoky for them to perform. It's not safe, so it's not good for anybody when the art is stopped. So it's that specific thing is a serious threat to art and to business. One thing I would throw out there, we, in terms of like the question of how depressed we are, mm-hmm. We're not. I had a fascinating conversation with Tony Leiserwitz at the Yale Climate Communication Center, and I said, "Do you ever get down about this stuff?" And he said, "No. This is the possibilities that we face, the possibilities we have in front of us are incredible. This is an incredible time of change. We have the power to direct the change, and there will be damage we can't avoid, but we don't know the future, right? And we can be the generation that saved the planet in a literal sense. And when you are given that gift, how can you not accept it? How can you not step into it? And when you step into that, then you as Alan said, you're not, depression doesn't have a place in your soul because you got the work in front of you to do. So, I heard the caller saying about not bringing children into this world, but I brought children into this world, and I'm going to take care of them. And that's how I travel through the day.
Okay, let's take a call here. We want to hear from your community and what's going on with climate change where you live, 800-838-3760, or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's James in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Alan, Hannah, Tanya, and Allison.
Oh, what a crew. Thank you for being on, all of you. Really appreciate it. My name is Jim McGinnis, and I'm also on the Climate Energy Action Plan here in Ashland Committee. And tonight we're going to meet with the City Council to bring the first reading of our proposal for the City of Ashland, the City and Community of Ashland. One of the biggest challenges we have, and by the way, I had an opportunity. I didn't know it was going to happen right away, but when Ron Wyden was here, I asked the question, what are you willing to do or what are you doing back in D.C. To help support us locally here with a plan that is proposed to be the most stringent in the country? And since we've been talking about consumer side of things or consumption side here in Ashland, in a regional sense, is about 50% of all of our greenhouse gas emissions. And that is probably the biggest challenge that we would have locally to be able to overcome and reach an 8% per year up through 350% reduction in greenhouse gases. So I'd like to just kind of throw that out to the to the crew there and ask you to address that. I just want to make one small announcement as well. Here in Ashland on this week on the, let's see, in the SOU, Science Building at 7:30. We're going to have Casey Golden speaking at Southern Oregon University, and he's a board member of the 350.org. So I want to let people know that as well.
We have Casey.
And thank you. I'll take your comments off. Yeah.
All right. Thank you, James. We do have Casey Golden coming in at the 9 o'clock hour on Thursday. So thanks for the reminder there, Jim. So let me throw it out to the table. Hannah, let's start with you because we're talking at a focus on younger people. I mean, do they generally have no problems with trying to reduce their energy consumption? Are they do they get enthused about this rather than depressed, as we've talked about a couple times in this hour?
I mean, I can't speak for all young people, but
speak for everybody in your age bracket. Yeah.
You know, I think that young people tend to drive less. Young people tend to buy less. Young people tend to have less resources. So, you know, already young people are consuming less than older generations are. But I think that we also really have to move away from this frame that it's all about individual consumption, because we know that it's really we consume what's we are part of systems, and the energy that we have the option to provide is part of policies and systems. The transportation that we have the options to take are part of policies that are made. And so, you know, with our young people, we really don't even focus on individual consumption, because what we're teaching our young people is how to engage in political action, how to run for office, how to hold our local and our state leaders accountable, and how to really push for policies that change the systems that we live in. And so, you know, with young people, we there's some things that we're doing in, like in talent, we're doing a light bulb switch out. But even if we switch out every single light bulb in talent, we're only going to reduce the energy in talent by 4%. And so it's useful because we get to talk to everybody in our neighborhood. We get to reduce energy bills for people who need, who are paying a lot of money on their energy bills. But that's just a piece of the puzzle. And so, we are, you know, the next step is to really engage our whole communities in systems change. And, you know, a lot of our consumption also has to do with policies. So the food that we have access to has to do with land use policies, and it has to do with fossil fuel subsidies. And so we really are, we don't spend a lot of time with our youth talking about consumption, because we are teaching them how to change systems.
You show a lot of interconnections then between those systems, that everything's interrelated.
Mm-hmm. And as everything is related in terms of how we function as a society, and I see among young people and a lot of older people too, a real sense that any division between, say, social justice and environmental justice is completely false. Mm-hmm. And you need to sort of take it all on at once. And so I see in Rogue Climate and other groups, you know, the willingness to reach across organization to organization in terms of really seeing at our core values are all the same. And once you realize that, then suddenly you have this web of people that you're working with, which is much larger than you might have thought, and you increase your power and your ability to get things done exponentially.
We're talking generally about people who already accept the reality of what we're talking about. But Alan Jornet, I have to wonder if you're still having discussions with people about, I mean, and you are a scientist yourself, a biology professor originally, weren't mm-hmm. you? What kinds of conversations you still get into with people who are skeptics? How do you deal with skeptics at this late date?
Well, yes, indeed, we certainly engage in conversations and with the folks who are don't accept the science, and many of them, unfortunately, are our representatives. But my take is to when I'm hearing people arguing against the science, is to ask exactly what component of the science it is that they reject, and then engage in a discussion of that particular component of the science. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes folks are so locked into their anti-science position that the conversations falter when they end up denying the physical properties of matter in some way or other, which doesn't leave us many places to go. Hmm. But I think the point is to engage in conversations with folks and do the best you can. I did want to make a point back on the consumption question that Jim asked. And that is, I just as Hannah was saying, when each of us individually does the best we can, it doesn't make a tremendous difference. But I look upon individual action as being a necessary but insufficient response to the problem.
A first step, perhaps?
It's necessary, because if we individually don't do the best we can in terms of reducing our consumption, minimizing our energy use, et cetera, then we're not in a position to discuss that with anybody else, much less are we in a position to talk to representatives and say, we want you to behave in such a way that you change policies that Hannah was talking about, policies regarding energy sources. And that's where we are at the state level. We absolutely need to get the collective action going at the state level, so that our energy, we have to use energy, but it doesn't have to come from fossil fuel.
Before we go, we've got about 5 minutes left here, and I want to ask about two programs, one involving the GEOS Institute, ClimateWise, which I notice has a registered trademark on it. What can you tell us about ClimateWise and how that works?
So our ClimateWise initiative helps local leaders and communities understand what future conditions are likely to be like in their particular area. And then we take them through a process to identify what does that mean in terms of their vulnerability and risks, and what are the strategies that they can undertake to reduce those risks over time. So it's really a process of starting communities down that path of building climate resilience and adaptation, and then helping to translate the science for them and make those pieces accessible that they might have difficulty with if they were just trying to do it on their own. And our goal over time is to make sure that communities across the country that are wanting to take action on climate change and build that resilience have the support and the services that they need to do that effectively.
So as we continue to talk about the things that can be done within communities, though, what is the thing that all communities together must do? I mean, what do you communicate, Hannah Soule, through Rogue Climate that is the big thing that needs to change for us to begin to reverse the amount of carbon in the atmosphere?
Well, there's a lot that needs to change. You know,
Is there a first one, though? I mean,
What we have decided as an organization, the first thing to tackle is really our energy use. And so we're looking at kind of three things. The first one is really changing state policies, so putting a limit on climate pollution, having the largest polluters pay their fair share, and then using that money to invest into communities like those in Southern Oregon that really need it most, communities of color, low-income communities, into things like access to transportation, making our buildings more energy efficient. And so the one thing that we're really focusing on is changing our state policies so we have a comprehensive state policy that can transition us to clean energy. And then, you know, each city and each community can also start doing their own planning. So some of that is adaptation, like what Tanya works on, and some of that is changing how we use energy. And then I think the third piece that we really feel like is so important right now is to not have any more fossil fuel development, not stop pipelines, stop this huge push to get the last bit of fossil fuels out of the ground. And so we are, you know, really still continuing to work hard to stop the Pacific Connector pipeline. And actually, there's an open house on March 23rd in Medford.
Those were rescheduled, right?
Rescheduled,
yep. Set back 2 weeks? Okay.
Yeah, so
March 23rd is an open house set up by whom?
For Veresen. So Veresen is the company that's been proposing this Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector pipeline for the last 10 years. And they've lost twice. It's been shut down twice. And just in February, they have reproposed the pipeline for a third time. And so they're holding four open houses as part of their required process with FERC, one in North Bend, one in Canyonville, one in Medford, and one in Klamath Falls on March 23rd is in Medford. Yep.
Okay.
And so we really hope a lot of folks can show up and let the company know that our communities are ready to transition to clean energy.
Okay. That's at 4 o'clock at the Ramada.
Mm-hmm. 4 p.m. at the Ramada. Okay. Thanks for bringing that in, Alan. And before we go to Allison, I want to hear about SOF, Oregon Shakespeare Festival's participation in the climate change theater action.
Oh, well, yeah, there've been a bunch of different sort of involvement in collections of short plays that can be done all over the by theaters all over the country and written by international writers and local writers, and so it's an exciting and ongoing project, right? You can never have too little art. You can never have too much art.
Uh-huh.
You can't have too little art. So, and the other thing that we're doing is supporting the upcoming Climate Bash by having OSF performers participate with song and poem and speech and other fun things. And I know that we want to talk about that Climate Bash, too.
You are right. You can read the clock as well as anybody can. I know we have about a minute or two left here, but so let's talk about the Rogue Valley Climate Bash. You're all involved with this, and one of the things I noticed is that it's at the Ashland Armory, the historic armory, I presume,
yes,
on the 17th at 6:30 p.m. And one of the things I noticed at the flyers was, no science talks, we promise. Truly?
Exactly. Truly. This is a celebration. So we've had incredible success over the last 2 years or so of really moving climate policy, signing the Paris agreements, the Pope's encyclical. There's a lot that's moving on climate change, and there's a lot to be celebrated. There's also a lot to be protected in our current political situation. And so we want this to be a celebration. It will be fun. There will be no hockey stick graphs and no science presentations. But we want people to come out, have a good time, and really see how they can engage with us, with SOCAN, with Rogue Climate, with Citizens Climate Lobby, and with Indivisible. And OSF is helping us to make that a really fun, engaging event. Peter Buckley will be emceeing it for us.
All right. So you said Shakespeare Festival actors are there too as well, Alice and Carrie?
Yeah. Because, there are a lot of them in our Green Task Force. There's lots of people who care about this, and we're all going to bring what we can to the table.
All right. So that is the 17th again. That's St. Patrick's Day, which happens to fall on a Friday this year. Good luck to the police that night. St. Patrick's Day, the 17th, is the Rogue Valley Climate Bash, 6:30 at the Ashland Armory. What does it cost to get in?
Suggested donation of $10, but we certainly want everybody to come who wants to be there. So,
okay. Well, I'm glad we got a chance to explore lots of ways to affect local action in dealing with a global issue of climate change. Good to have you all here today. Alan Journay from Southern Oregon Climate Action Now, Hannah Soule from Rogue Climate, Tanya Graham from the Geos Institute, and Allison Carey putting her furniture away at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Thank you all for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay.